Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is one of America's most distinguished public servants, Ambassador Paula Dobriansky. From 2001 to 2009, she served as Undersecretary of State for Democracy and Global Affairs, the longest serving in history. Among her primary achievements, Ambassador Dobriansky established and led the U.S.-India, U.S.-China, and U.S.-Brazil Global Issues Fora, which advanced crucial work and international cooperation on environment, health, development, and humanitarian issues. In addition, she was head of delegation and lead negotiator on U.S. climate change policy. During her successful career in government, Ambassador Dobriansky also served as associate director for policy and programs at the former U.S. Information Agency, or USIA, deputy assistant secretary of state for human rights and humanitarian affairs, and deputy head of the U.S. delegation to the 1990 Copenhagen Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. For her cumulative leadership, Ambassador Dobriansky received the Secretary of State's highest honor, the Distinguished Service Medal. She is currently Senior Fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. She joins us at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to discuss a range of international issues, including the crisis in Ukraine, the nexus between energy and national security, climate change, and the importance of gender equality, particularly in a post-Karzai Afghanistan. Ambassador Dobriansky, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm very delighted to be here this morning with you and also with your audience.
Let's go first, Ambassador, to the crisis in Ukraine, which has strained U.S.-Russian relations. And of course, the chief of NATO has called Russian aggression in Ukraine the greatest challenge to Europe in a generation. We witnessed, of course, Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea and now its attempts to destabilize eastern Ukraine. Do you agree that the battle over Ukraine and Russia's aggressive posture pose one of the greatest challenges to Europe in a generation? What do you think is at stake?
Absolutely. There's a great deal that's at stake here. First, it's not only the action that was taken, the illegal invasion and unlawful annexation of Ukraine, and what it does to Ukraine, the destabilization, the attempt at weakening Ukraine as it is striving to become associated with Europe and to put in place political and economic reforms. But there are other ramifications of what is at stake here that affects the globe at large. The first being, very significantly, that these actions have actually put into question the international order, international norms, international law, legal norms as we know it, because of the illegal aggression. It defies the structure of the fact that there has not been this kind of overt aggression that's been taken on the continent. So the first is that, which is very important and has ramifications for other parts of the world. But I will tell you a second that many have not focused on, and that is it also undermines nonproliferation. In 1994, the United States, the UK, and Russia signed the Budapest Memorandum. And what happened there was Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. Ukraine at the time had the third largest nuclear forces in the world, and it gave up its nuclear arsenal in return for respect for its territorial integrity and sovereignty. So this sends a very bad message, the message being that a document like this undercuts proliferation, if you will, non-proliferation efforts. So other countries in Asia, in the Middle East, they're all watching these steps closely. It is of great concern.
What you said is tremendously important, and that leads me to ask you then about the U.S. and European response to the aggression. Now, the United States and Europe have imposed sanctions on Russian and Ukrainian individuals who have fomented destabilization and violence. Germany, however, is particularly reluctant to push too hard given business interests and the fact that the EU depends on Russia for about a third of its gas needs. Given these factors, what more should the United States do, in your view? What other tools do we have at our disposal to deter Russia from further aggression?
Well, I think there are a number of tools that we have at our disposal, and also there have been a number of requests that have been put forward. First, let's talk about the political lane. I think it's very important that the West stands united on this issue and indicates that we cannot recognize this unlawful aggression in Crimea as we go forward. Other steps that may be taken, if they transgress and go over the line in terms of the lack of respect for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, I think we should be holding firm in being politically united. Secondly, there's the economic lane. You've mentioned sanctions that have been put in place that are targeting a select number of advisors. These are advisors who are engaged in kinds of corrupt financial actions and in which these measures can and should hurt. However, there are other economic sanctions which the West together can be looking at, and that is in the context of closing down and shutting down markets that would not be open to Russians, whether they're seeking credit or seeking loans, what have you. I think that is an area that has to be on the table. And then there is the military area. Let me put that out, because you have the countries of Poland, the Baltic states, in particular, Latvia has some 27% of their population are ethnic Russians, 26% in Estonia. So they want to see a kind of forward deployment of NATO troops on the border to deter any further aggressive actions. I think those are also options that are on the table, including the option Ukraine has solicited military training, support. It had been emasculated of its military assets during the time, in particular more recently under Yanukovych. And so there is also another option that needs to be looked at. And finally is the energy option. Mm-hmm. This is a potent one. Russia relies very heavily on its energy exports, both oil and gas. And in this case, it's understandable in the sense that Europe puts out that, look, a large portion of our energy is relying on Russia, but here's an alternative for them. And this isn't a change that has to be done overnight, but let's say they take targets, 20% or 30%, where they cut off the supplies they're getting from Russia, and in turn, look at the United States. We certainly can provide LNG, and we should be doing that. That is a very viable option.
I want to get into that in a moment about the United States perhaps stepping up its export of liquefied natural gas. But let me step back one more time and take a look at the impact of this crisis on U.S.-Russian relations, which were presumably reset. We were in a cooperative mode to some extent under the Obama administration, whether on Iran, North Korea, Syria, a number of issues. What do you think Vladimir Putin wants in Ukraine? I mean, we know that Ukraine is very important to Russia's identity, sort of straddles the East and the West. What do you think he's looking to do? And how will this affect U.S.-Russian relations on a number of issues for which Russia's cooperation is quite important? For example, as I said, Iran, Syria, North Korea, and many others.
Well, on the first, what is it that he is seeking? He is certainly seeking, and he's even said it himself directly, he is seeking an establishment of a Eurasian Union, and that Eurasian Union would bring together, as he sees it, countries that he would like to have embracing values, values that are not the values of the West. Here, I think what the challenge is and the issue is with regard to Ukraine, he is seeking to force a situation on Ukraine, which it doesn't exist. And that is that Ukraine has been a united country. There have been no secessionist movements since its independence. And in fact, ethnic Ukrainians have been living peaceably together with ethnic Russians and Russian-speaking Ukrainians and Russian-speaking Russians all together have been peaceably existing in Ukraine. These current situations that we have surfaced have been triggered, have been provocations. And here you had demonstrations that took place last year and even up to the present, which underscored two core considerations that Ukrainians want. First, they said they want an association with the European Union. They wanted the association with the European, not only because of the ties, the political, the values, but also because of the economic opportunities. This would have to bring about economic reforms. And most significantly, and it's the second reason for these demonstrations, was the fact that you have leaders who are corrupt in Ukraine, in Russia, and the strong desire to change that and to ensure that instead what you will have is a clean and functioning government. So what you have is Putin trying to put Ukraine in a situation which doesn't exist. I think that the people of Ukraine should be able to put together their program and in a way that has united the country and I'm sure will continue to unite the country prior to these provocations.
Ambassador Dobryansky, do you think that Vladimir Putin is creating a pretext for additional military action by covertly fueling unrest in eastern Ukraine? And when the U.S. warns of consequences, a high price to pay, what do you think that means concretely? What is the United States and the West willing to do if Russia continues this destabilization?
Well, I think one has to be gravely concerned when you have troops that are amassed at the border, and then you have these provocations taking place internally, which have been protested against by the Ukrainian government. And then you look at the countries, the neighbors in the region, who are also very concerned and watching these actions very, very closely. So one can only surmise what would happen. I do think it's quite important at this time that the West show a very strong, united, and very targeted response to these actions. And in particular, I think going back to these military options, Poland, the Baltic countries have made an appeal to NATO when NATO met. And they said, we need to have these assets. We need to have an on-the-ground deterrent. I know that some actions have been taken, but more critically needs to be done. And there's a second aspect that we cannot forget. And that is during this time, all of these actions have really targeted a weak Ukraine. And Ukraine is trying to shore itself up. So also, that's another area the United States, Europe, must be vigilant in providing the kind of assistance that is being solicited here.
You know, some analysts are talking about echoes of a Cold War, again, despite the lack of an ideological dimension and the fact that there are no nuclear weapons trained on each other, that is, between the United States and Russia. How do you see this analogy?
Well, I think that we clearly are witnessing a serious kind of tension. I do think that if Russia opts to pursue these aggressive goals further, I think that all experts will come to the conclusion that this is a revival of the Cold War. But let me also add something here that I think is important. The term Cold War has been used. But I think we need to be very vigilant to the fact that Putin is redefining the international order. He has targeted the international order as it has existed, the kind of legal norms that have been respected by all countries. And this is of grave concern. It's of grave concern because it does send messages to others in other parts of the globe that there isn't a respect for legal norms. There isn't a respect for international law. And we know that there are all kinds of disputes that are playing out in other parts of the world. So what the United States and the West does here matters greatly, not just only for this region, but as a signal to others as well.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador Paula Dobryansky, former U.S. Undersecretary of State for Democracy and Global Affairs, currently Senior Fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And as always, we love to hear from you. Please send your feedback on this and other programs to PCUSA@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and if you listen to PCUSA via the radio or the internet. Here's a shout out to loyal listener Chibundu Uchegbu from Nigeria. Well, back to you, Ambassador Dobrianski. And let's talk about your work on unconventional sources of energy, particularly here in the United States with the boom in shale gas. The United States is set to actually surpass Saudi Arabia in the production of oil and gas, perhaps in another 5 to 10 years. This has tremendous implications for energy security, for national security, particularly as it even relates to Russia. What about this longer-term strategy, trying to accelerate the export of natural gas, shale gas, to Europe? Is this viable? Do you see this in the offing?
It's a very viable option, and it's one that should be pursued. Let's say if the recent events had not occurred in Crimea and Ukraine, that this is an approach that the United States needed to be looking at and needed to be moving on. Why does it matter? First of all, I think those who are pursuing various approaches for an energy policy believe strongly that we, to maintain a strong foundation, really need to have a kind of diversified approach. And here, actually, by our providing and enhancing these LNG, liquefied natural gas, exports to Europe, it will benefit Europe because Europe will not be as dependent as it has been in the case of Russia. But at the same time, it will also be a benefit to us economically and also in terms of just our own, if you will, geopolitical strategies. So I think its time has certainly come. There's been a debate going on in the United States as to whether this should happen or not happen. And I think we're well past that debate. The time is now to really move forward on these exports, to diversify our energy portfolio and our energy policy strategy. And as I said, significantly, it's not just benefiting the United States, but it also is benefiting and can benefit countries like Europe that are very desirous of not becoming as dependent as they have been in the case of Russia.
And of course, it will lessen U.S. dependence on oil from the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Will that free us up in terms of our policies? Will we be less likely to, you know, acquiesce in perhaps positions by Saudi Arabia and others because we will have a freer hand?
Well, you know, it's very interesting that you mention this point because I think one of the most important issues here is how do you have a balanced approach? I know that when I was a year ago in Turkey, actually, I remember a Saudi businessman came up to me and he said, I'm very concerned about what's happening in the United States in the energy field. Does this mean that you will cut off ties with us? Does this mean that we will not interact at all in this sphere? And a report that I was just affiliated with, sponsored by the Center for New American Security, looks at these geopolitical implications. And where we came out, and I think it's right, let's have a balanced approach. We, on one hand, don't want to be subject to the vicissitudes and changes of all kinds of policies and circumstances abroad. But at the same time, we also want to be not disengaged. So we don't want to be held hostage, you know, and literally dependent on relationships with other countries, but we don't want to alienate. Mm-hmm. And I think that was his message. So I think it was a good message, an important one, and there needs to be balance here, that as we go forward and we enhance those exports and we provide for those LNG terminals and build those terminals, that at the same time that what we should be doing is we should be trying to figure out ways of still collaborating with countries in the Middle East, with countries in Europe and different parts of the world, and where we have been reliant.
On a related issue, Ambassador Dobrianski, climate change policy, you've been very active in that arena, the importance of reducing emissions of greenhouse gases. This is critical for the environment going forward. And while the Obama administration has developed a climate action plan, the U.S. Congress has not done so and has failed to adopt any climate change legislation, even though states have picked up some of the slack. What do you think the United States can practically do without the support of Congress, both here domestically and globally?
Well, actually, whether it's the United States or it's another country, you actually said it in your question. And that is, action at a local level usually is the most sustainable, it's the most impactful, and it also, it can really matter to the community, and it usually is also the most cost-effective. A lot of times, there have been strategies put forth by countries of top-down approaches, and these top-down approaches don't pay attention to the circumstances on the ground or the economies. So, one of the things that I think can and should be done is what is happening. Let's just take in the United States. You have a lot of very interesting developments happening at local levels. And why does that matter? Because some communities are better equipped to deal with renewable energies. They might have better circumstances vis-a-vis solar power versus wind power or hydropower. Other communities are interested in looking at how you deal with energy efficiency, building codes, the building of new communities, and how to make them more energy efficient. Some of our states are coal-based. And by the way, there's some incredible innovative technologies that are being built. For example, the state of Mississippi has lignite coal, and there you have the first of its kind of carbon capture and gasification, and then taking that carbon and turning it into enhanced oil recovery. These kinds of groundbreaking innovations and technologies are so applicable to other parts of the world that are grappling with how do you deal with climate change. So I place a premium on innovation, technologies, looking at sustainable ways forward, and that you don't have to have one blueprint, that's going to fit all sizes and all situations.
Before I let you go, Ambassador Dobryansky, let's turn briefly to the historic election in Afghanistan and the role of women. Women have made enormous strides in the last decade since the Taliban have left power. But of course, notwithstanding the election and the future of the country under a more democratic leadership, there are risks that there could be backsliding for women. Why is it so important that women's rights be maintained? And how can the United States and the West ensure that women will play a role in the future of that country?
Well, first, women are not half citizens, no matter where they are. They're full citizens and they're contributors to a country, to a community, to a society. The women of Afghanistan have been truly phenomenal. They have really been courageous. They've been innovative. And they have fought for their rights. They have every right to an education, every right to a job, every right to have health benefits. In this case, their role in Afghanistan has been not only significant because women actually, I believe, outpopulate men, and they're the ones who mostly show up at the polls and did show up at the polls. But secondly, they're also a very strong contributing members of society. And in that sense, Afghanistan can only benefit from it because of their ability to contribute to the growth and the economy of that society. I've been a long time involved with what's called the U.S.-Afghan Women's Council, which was started in the Bush administration and has continued now in the Obama administration. And I think it's been a very important network. It's a network that builds upon the goals and the objectives that the Afghan women put forward themselves: education, health, legal and human rights, political rights, and then no less the ability to have your own business and to grow that business. So in this case, it's not just only good for women because of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that women have full-fledged rights, but it's also of benefit to Afghanistan itself in terms of its objectives, its growth, its mission.
And lastly, Ambassador Dobryansky, you were Under Secretary of State for Democracy and Global Affairs. You have a keen view of the U.S. role on the world stage. I was wondering if you could just critique the Obama administration's foreign policy posture. You know, some have criticized that it's been ineffective, rather weak. How do you see the U.S. role in the world and how the Obama administration has approached crises, including the one in Ukraine, vis-a-vis Syria, U.S.-China relations, and so forth?
Well, I would first begin by saying that I do think that U.S. leadership does matter greatly. I think that it is always looked to, and whether it's in tandem with other countries in terms of solving a problem, or even singularly, our voice, our strength, our involvement does, in fact, matter. In this case, I also think that it's important in many cases. You've mentioned a number of situations, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's Ukraine. I think that unity of purpose also matters. Let's take Ukraine. We spent time talking about it, and one of the points I made was how crucial it is that here it's a unified Western approach. It can't just be the United States alone. Here it does have to be the West together. That will make a difference on the ground. So I will say, I think in sum, what we do matters greatly. It has been the case, it is, it will. But I also think a partnership, thinking through how you can use a variety of assets and partnerships and alliances with other countries also matters as well.
Ambassador Paula Dobriansky was Undersecretary of State for Democracy and Global Affairs from 2001 to 2009. She's currently Senior Fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. Ambassador Dobriansky, thank you so much for coming in, sharing your fabulous insights with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineers were Ted Schneider and Glenn Von Calio, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.